This episode of the CSEN podcast was recorded by Dr. Ole Rammel and Dr. Rogelio Mercado from the CSEN Center. You can listen to our other episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the first CSEN podcast of 2024. My name is Ole, and I'm the Director of Macroeconomic and Monetary Policy Management at the CSEN Center, and I'm very pleased to welcome you all. And I'm joined today by my colleague, Rogelio, who is a senior economist and our capital flows expert, amongst many other things. The CSEN Center issued its first capital flows monitor in June of 2018, and you may have seen one of our five issues that ran from, as I said, June 2018 to 2020. And we did on the 19th of July, on a memorable evening, 2019, Rogelio and I did a podcast in Siem Reap accompanying the inaugural issue of the Capital Flows Monitor. And for those of you who are interested, you might want to listen to the CSEN podcast from that day. The Capital Flows Monitor was was issued biannually from June 18 up to June 2020. And then we had a bit of a break. And we've just reissued our first new style capital flows monitor in December of last year. And Rogelio and I thought that it might be a nice idea to revisit, to have sort of a mark two of our initial podcast from July 2018. And so here we are again together talking about our new capital flows monitor, which we will again issue biannually. All of the editions are available on our website. And let me kick off with just asking Roger what about the long gap between the last issue released in June 2020 and the latest issue released in late December 2023. What explains the long gap that we had?
Thank you so much, Ole, and I'm happy to be back here in your podcast. I do remember our first podcast in Siem Reap when we launched the first issue of the Capital Flows Monitor. To directly answer the question, there are a lot of things that happened in 2020. First, we had, of course, the pandemic. So there was this move towards doing online courses. We were sort of knowing how we can actually deliver some of the output given limited manpower, because I myself was away during the pandemic years at CSEN. And more importantly, we had this request from our stakeholders, the CSEN member central banks, monetary authorities, that we sort of complete capital flow studies, which we did. So for 2020, 21, 22, we've been working on the report on capital flows, and now it's actually, you know, released as a edited book volume called Challenges and Options in Managing Capital Flows for Small, Open, and Financially Integrated Economies. So I guess most of our effort were all directed towards completing that project, which was requested to us by our member central banks. Now come in July 2022, again, we resumed with the CSEN expert group on capital flows meeting, and with new co-chairs, Senior Assistant Governor Lou Sikat of BSP, as well as Assistant Governor Frazia Lee Ismail of Bank Negara Malaysia. So as a part of the secretariat of that CSEN expert group on capital flows, we took the initiative again to sort of reissue the capital flows monitor as a form of our deliverable to the CSEN expert group as to monitor or to do some surveillance work on capital flows for the CSEN expert group members or the SEG members. So overall, that's what explains the gap for the June 2020 to the December 2023 issue, because of course we had the pandemic, we had limited manpower, and at the same time we were focusing on the research project, which was requested to us by our member central banks on capital flows. So but now we're back, and we hope to continue doing this on a regular basis as before.
Yeah, I mean, I'll obviously ask you a lot of questions about the current issue. Just wanted to reiterate, capital flows are top of mind of many of our policymakers in the region for some of the reasons we will discuss in this podcast. So it's one of the big topics that we are monitoring and analyzing. If you're interested in the book that Rogelio mentioned, Challenges and Options in Managing Capital Flows for Small, Open and Financially Integrated Economies, it's also available on our website for download. So let's get right to the latest capital flows monitor. And let me ask Rogelio what the key changes in the current issue of the capital flows monitor are. In particular, what was the rationale for making those changes, and should we expect further changes in future editions of the monitor?
Okay, so one of the main changes that we did was we added an additional section, which is now section one of the monitor, where we sort of discuss the global and regional economic developments and trends that actually impact capital flows, not only in our region, but globally. So this actually comes from the rationale for adding this section is that, of course, it is mostly this global or regional or external factors that are main drivers of capital flows to which policymakers must sort of need to monitor, to keep track, to keep an eye on. So having that sort of section, additional section as the first section of the monitor, sorts of it sets the tone for the whole report, because it would then be followed by the discussion on the capital flows, patterns, trends, as well as changes in external positions measured by the International Investment Position, or the IIP, and then consequently the analytical section, which is section three. So in this section, in the succeeding sections that we will be issuing, we will have that section one, which would discuss or highlight key global trends or drivers of capital flows that, you know, that could warrant some consideration or warrant some monitoring from our stakeholders. And then section two would be the same format as we had before, where we look into the balance of payments data from our member central banks, and then also the international investment position. So as before, we decided to keep the analytical section because I think it's one of the most interesting part of the monitor. It sort of changes every issue. So here we sort of highlight one important topic on capital flows, on current account, on international external adjustment. That's not necessarily, you know, the on being discussed in mainstream, but, you know, something that we might want to highlight to our readers that could eventually be explored again in a more rigorous manner, either through a working paper or a study or additional report. So those are the key change. And one last is that In the previous issues, we had the section three where we present the data itself. So we decided that since we have a lot of charts in this monitor, we might as well just do away with the data appendix, which was section three in the previous issues, because most of these data are available anyway through when you look into the IMF's data balance of payments and international investment position statistics. They have that data. Even our own member central banks, when you look into their own website, they release their balance of payments data. So I mean, we see it a bit of redundant to have additional section on that, whereas what we can do is add another section that can dis- discussed global trends, global economic developments that will impact capital flows not only for one economy, but also for all economies in our region, who are particularly those that are CSEN member central banks, that we can actually look into what factors can affect movement of capital flows in their economies. So those are the changes. And for now, we will try to keep this format. Hopefully, we get positive feedback from it. And so we would do a little changes for, I guess, in the next coming issues of the monitor. And hopefully we get a good feedback. But of course, you know, any institutional report, they can change over time. I mean, who knows, in 2 or 3 years' time, we may have a different format. But as long as for now we sort of have some consistency in terms of what sections we include and what topics we discuss. So those are the changes that we have in this current issue.
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, I very much agree with you on the importance of the analytical section, having contributed to it myself in terms of, you know, a discussion of reserve adequacy or yes. a sort of a benchmark for capital flows. Oops. I think that's a very nice outlet for us to highlight particular issues. I mean, the other point I would just like to note is the important role of, there are many capital flows documents. I think what sets ours apart is our emphasis on the CSEN members, which obviously include 19 economies in the Asia Pacific, 19 very important members in the Asia Pacific region. So this is a focus on our members on capital flows in general and on our members in particular. Let me get right back to the new first section, the key messages or the highlights. And you noted, or we noted, several findings and trends pertaining to economic and financial conditions, as well as capital flow patterns and trends in the region and elsewhere. In your opinion, what do you think is the single most important driver of capital flows in the recent period?
I think the most important one that we can really see its impact on the trend is actually the interest rate, particularly the U.S. policy rate. Of course, related to that is the domestic policy rates, as well as inflation. So all these three factors are, I guess, all related to one another. But if we will highlight one, I think that would be the U.S. Policy rate. So as we know, the U.S. policy rate was increased in 2022, and this is in response to stronger inflationary pressures. And this inflationary pressures is driven by both demand and as well as supply side. On the demand side, remember in 2022, this was the time when economies were sort of opening up again. Excuse me. And so there was sort of some sort of pent up demand, as they say. So there's this demand side factor. But then at the same time, there were also supply side pressures and coming from, let's say, some structural changes that are being done, let's say the shortening of the supply chains, as they say, disruptions in the supply chains. If you remember, there was the news on the Suez Canal that there was this, you know, a boat that was stuck there. And then so most of the shipping containers they have to reroute. And so that delayed supply, and that caused some, you know, supply bottlenecks, and that contributed to cost factors of companies who wants to produce products. There were also some geopolitical challenges, risks that happened. Let's say, for instance, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which is still ongoing, had some impact on commodity and agricultural prices because both are exporters. So this factors, these inflationary factors led to an increase in U.S. policy rates, and then as well as domestic interest rate. And as a result, the single most important factor would be particularly the U.S. policy rate, which is of course external to members, to the domestic economies of CSEN member central banks. And as we know, U.S. policy rate, some sort, is very important because this is some sort of this is important because it somehow will set the tone for other global rates, and at the same time, this can trigger, you know, a decline in U.S. investment as well as investments in other countries. So that is the most single important factor. And of course, I mean, that inflationary pressures also happen to other CSEN member economies. So they've also raised policy rates. And that also has an impact on investments, whether it be domestic or cross-border investments.
Thank you for that. Let me put you on the spot a little bit with a follow-up question. As you mentioned, the U.S. policy rate is the primary mover of cross-border investments, or has been the primary mover of cross-border investments in the past year or so. Now, this is not investment advice. We are not making a forecast, but I'm not asking Roger to make a forecast, but what are your thoughts on the near-term direction of cross-border investments, and how do you think, or the U.S. policy rate, I guess, and what do you think, or how do you think it will affect capital inflows to the region?
That's the million-dollar question. No? I mean, we had several discussions with other financial sector specialists, which we acknowledged in our report, and the idea is that, depending on the development of the U.S. inflation, particularly during the winter months, which, for instance, this week they just released the December inflation report, which is around 3.4%, which is still quite high compared to the 2.5%, you know, average monthly inflation rate in the U.S. So whether there would be, let's say, a rate pause or rate cut, in my view, it will really depend on how inflation will develop in the first quarter during the winter months. Of course, we know that at some point the Fed can just simply pause its decision, but whether it will really cut, when it will start to cut, that can come, of course, this year. But then when will depend? I think it will most likely depend on how inflation behaves during the winter months in the Northern Hemisphere. In the impact of that is that if, for instance, say the U.S. already decides to either, let's say, cut policy rates towards the end of the year, whereas some economies in the region have not fully, let's say, controlled inflation and they decide to pause their policy action or their interest rate decision, then that can sort of lead to varying, you know, interest rate differentials across the region, and that can somehow trigger some volatility in capital flow. So, for instance, say for example, the one economy still has some, you know, needs to still control inflation, hence they need to maintain a high interest rate, but the U.S. would, let's say, will start to cut, let's say, policy rate towards the end of the year or even earlier, then there would be some widening of interest rate differential, and that can actually cause some volatility in terms of capital flows to the region. So that is that's the impact of any U.S. policy action that could happen to capital flows going into the region. Yeah.
Of course, we should. I should add that Roger mentioned the closure of the Suez Canal and the U.S. inflation reading. I should add that the latest inflation numbers in the euro area, or the December inflation numbers in the euro area and the UK, were also higher than had an uptick. So the sort of the downward path stopped. And of course, we have renewed conflict in the Red Sea, affecting shipping lanes and shipping. So let's see what, you know, we need to see what the impact of that will be. Let's get back to the to capital flows, though. The report states that the region's resident and non-resident capital flows remained smaller compared to recent periods due to higher US and domestic interest rates. Can you elaborate on this finding, and what periods are you comparing here?
So when we compared the average resident and non-resident capital flows to Asia, this time as in percent of GDP, so basically we're sort of scaling the US dollar value of capital flows, we see that the average capital inflows, meaning non-resident inflows, for the period for the first half of 2022 up to the first half of 2023, the average was around 0.9% of regional GDP. If we compare the average capital flows during the pandemic, the value there is around 2.6% of regional GDP. And then during the pre-pandemic, which would be from the first half of 2018 to the second half of 2019, the average is around 2.1%. So on average, it's around 2%. The region receives around 2% of regional GDP size of capital inflows. But when we saw that the U.S. High inflation happened, and then the U.S. started to raise policy rates to address inflationary pressures, this is followed by also economies in the region experiencing inflation. They've also raised their policy rates. So in this scenario, we saw that the non-resident capital inflows going into the region has actually declined to around 0.9% of regional GDP. And the same pattern actually we can see when we look at actual resident flows. I mean, Asian investors investing elsewhere, it has also declined in this current period between the first half of 2022 up to the first half of 2023. So to me, this is a very interesting finding because it clearly shows that there is some form of relationship between a high interest rate environment, particularly say US, as well as domestic interest rate, as well as the volume or the size of capital flows going into the region. So in a way, this for me was quite an interesting and an exciting trend, because then we can say, global interest rate or US interest rate is back as a determinant of capital inflows, which it has been so in the past. When we look into the literature of capital flows in the 80s and 90s, they would always point out, the U.S. interest rate was quite low. That's why there was a surge in capital flows in Latin America as well as in Asia, but more so in Latin America. And so you can really see in those papers that they were really highlighting the role of the U.S. interest rate. And that for a long time, for over a decade, we recently had the global financial crisis. And so monetary policy has been moved towards, using quantitative easing. So we don't, when we run regressions, we don't see the significance or relevance of interest rate. But now it's sort of back. I mean, we can see that trend again. So it's a very, this is for me a quite very exciting, interesting finding that we had in this report.
I will get to that in a minute. Let me just pick up on something you said earlier. And you had a discussion about interest, the US interest rate, domestic interest rates, and interest rate differentials. So why is the US policy rate such a key driver of cross-border flows? Why not the domestic interest rate or the interest rate differential for that matter?
Because the U.S. interest rate, as we know, the capital flows are driven by global as well as domestic factors. For the global factors, the U.S. policy rate, which is somehow like a proxy for global interest rate, has played a dominant role because, of course, the U.S. has a very large financial system. It has a large investor base. Most of the global banks are headquartered in the U.S. And so the U.S. was actually a very large economy, and they provide a lot of investment products. And with that, a movement in the interest rate in the U.S. can actually cause changes in the behavior of, let's say, of investors, of borrowers, of lenders. So, for instance, if the U.S. interest rate increased, so there could be some funding constraint domestically, and so investors might in the U.S. might want to just invest and fill the gap of that financing constraint in the U.S. rather than, say, invest it somewhere else. And as a result, that sort of that is somehow it is, I mean, for the lack of a better word, maybe discourage that cross-border investment because a high domestic U.S. interest rate would need to, you know, it would require more funding domestically. So, you know, investors might be investing or filling in that financing constraint domestically. So that's one channel. Another channel is, of course, when the U.S. interest rate increases, investors, U.S. investors would just rather, you know, invest domestically, because of course they know the U.S. company that they're investing, they know what the stocks that they're going to buy or the securities that they're going to hold, and so as a result, the investment, it makes domestic assets somehow, you know, attractive to U.S. in investors. So because of this, you know, the U.S. Policy rate is very crucial and important. And for domestic interest rate, it also matters, of course, because then, you know, it will determine, you know, the funding needs of other economies, the emerging economies in particular. For in terms of the interest rate differential, now this is really, it's a sort of a gray area, even in empirical literature, on whether is it actually the interest rate itself, the global interest rate or the domestic interest rate, or is it the interest rate differential? This is still, you know, an open question on empirical literature. I guess it's because it's sort of hard to find an empirical evidence on this. It's because it can, the differential, the interest rate differential can move two ways, either because the US might be changing their interest rate or the domestic might be changed, might change their interest rate. But what we do know, and what we can actually infer from this, is that it might, the volatility of capital flows might somehow relate to this differential itself. You know, whether it will receive a high or a low, a high in one period and then low on another period, that might be more related to the differential. Because, of course, we know that somehow the U.S. interest rate, policy rate in particular, as well as domestic, they move, I mean, they move in one direction or they move slowly. But the differential, when you take the differential of the two, they can be moving or changing faster than either of the U.S. or domestic interest rate.
Yeah. Great. Thank you for that. And in the report, you state, or we state, that the region's resident and non-resident capital flows remain smaller. Oh, sorry, we had that next. And the statement I'm referring to is that Asian economies as a group continue to be a net capital exporter during the period. Could you elaborate on what you mean when you say that Asian economies are net capital exporters? Is that what economic theory would prescribe, and what indicators do you actually look at?
Okay, in terms of indicators, what we use is the International Investment Position, the IIP. The IIP is the stock equivalent of the balance of payment statistics, and it's a very useful statistics to tell us whether the economy is or it holds more foreign asset than it holds foreign liabilities. So if it holds more foreign liabilities than foreign asset, then the economy is a net debtor. I mean, it owes more to non-residents. Whereas if the economy has more foreign assets, then it's a net creditor, meaning it must be lending money abroad. So when we, as an aggregate, when we look across all the countries that we have in our sample, which are CSEN member economies, when we add all that up, we can clearly see that it is a net capital exporter, meaning it holds more as foreign assets than liabilities. However, when we look into different regions, different economies, we see some heterogeneity there. I mean, Asia is a very heterogeneous group of countries, you know, with different stages of development. Some are really advanced, some are developing. So what we find is that, let's say, China, including, let's say, Asian advanced economies such as Hong Kong, China, Chinese Taipei, Singapore, and Korea, these are really net capital exporters, meaning they hold more foreign assets than liabilities. Whereas countries such economies such as ASEAN 5, Asian frontier markets, and India, they hold more foreign liabilities than foreign assets. But as a group, as a whole, meaning the Asian economies, they hold more foreign assets. And I guess the reason for this is that most hold a lot of foreign reserves, and that in itself is foreign assets. And so that sort of explains the position of Asian economies. Now, to answer your question on whether this is sort of consistent with what we would expect, of course, well, there is a huge literature on this that explains why, you know, developing or emerging economies in Asia, why some of them are actually net capital exporters, or they've been purchasing U.S. Treasuries or assets. There are several reasons to this. One of which is it's because, let's say, the U.S. is, as mentioned, it's a large economy. It provides safe assets. Such as U.S. treasuries, and which economies they would want to hold it as a form of investments or even as a form of reserves. So that then explains the position. That's why we were sort of very clear to say that, you know, it's as a group, Asia itself is a net capital exporter. However, when we look into different economies or sub-regions or sub-groupings, we see differences across Asia as well.
Great, thank you. Let me turn to the analytical section. And in this report, there's a very interesting analysis using conditional correlations. This is section 3 of the report. What are those conditional correlations? And could you elaborate on the results as well as the policy implications?
So this nicely ties up with what I mentioned a while ago about the key statistics that really triggered this whole analytical section, is that we really find that the average capital inflows in the region for the period of first half of 2022 to first half of 2023 to be significantly lower compared to previous periods. So then again, we can really infer that, you know, this must be because of high U.S. policy rate. But then, of course, we need to provide further empirical evidence on that. So one way to do what we did is we ran a regression where we had capital inflows is regressed on different global as well as domestic factor, which is GDP growth. But in that regression specification, we are not, you know, controlling for causality. We're not lagging any variables there. So in a way, the estimated coefficient of the U.S. Policy rate in that regression can be considered, of course, as conditional correlation, conditional in a sense that you're holding other key important determinants of capital inflows constant when we interpret that regression coefficient. So what we find is true enough when we look into the non-resident capital inflows, a higher U.S. policy rate is significantly correlated with lower non-resident capital inflows. However, we had several different findings as well. So for instance, when we do the period split, we didn't find this significant for 2009 to 2014, but we do find it significant from 2015 to 2023, meaning that this is the period when sort of the U.S. was sort of normalizing its policy, its monetary policy, as well as it captures also the current period of high inflation, high U.S. policy rate. So that's one finding. It really mostly applicable or significant in the second period in our sample from 2015 to 2023. Another key finding we find is that it differs across types of capital flows, we see this inverse relationship very highly significant for other investment flows, which includes banking flows, such as, you know, non-resident currency deposits, trade credits, as well as loans. And then across economies, there's also there are differences. Let's say for China and India, we see that this the negative relationship between U.S. policy rate and capital flows is primarily driven by foreign direct investment. Whereas for advanced economies in the region, such as Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, China, Chinese Taipei, it's primarily driven by other investment flows. So to answer your question, we've used these conditional correlations as additional empirical evidence showing the relationship between a higher U.S. policy rate, as well as the level of capital flows going into the region. But of course, we did some different splits to really pin down which type of flow, which period this relationship tends to be stronger or more significant.
I hope our readers can get an appreciation of the effort that goes into one of these capital flows monitors. On that, obviously, there's going to be another capital flows monitor in June of this year, the June 2024 one. Can you share with us what analytical topics might be discussed in future editions of the capital flows monitor? And I'm sort of curious, how are the topics selected?
Okay, the topics are selected, I guess, based on, you know, how feasible it can be done. Number two, in a way, it should be very clear what the message is, well backed by, you know, evidence, either data or some empirical estimations, like what you did a section in the previous issue of the monitor. So we do have some criteria, like we should have some form of clear message of why we are looking into this. These analytical topics, I mean, they may not necessarily be like mainstream topics, but these are topics that we may need to highlight because they have some policy implication. Just to share with you, I mean, I think in the December 2018 issue, we did analytical section on the importance of defining extreme episodes of capital flows. I think that was the title. But basically, we're talking about surges and sudden stops. Now, that's very important because when we read, let's say, an integrated framework on capital flows and the use of capital flow management measures, they would always highlight, you know, surges. But then it is very important for us to have an understanding of how it can actually be measured or how do we define it. So that's the purpose of why we did that analytical section. And then when I read some of large international institutions in the region and based in Washington, they later on, when they were writing this, they were also already highlighting, you know, the importance of defining what a surge is, how can you empirically define it. And then when I read it, I was quite happy that, okay, we were, you know, the report was not cited, but at least, I mean, the topic that we had was sort of picked up by other institutions as well. So that was quite a good, topic to actually discuss. So in this case, for this issue, what we're saying is we're highlighting, we're showing everyone again, you know, the impact, the relationship between high U.S. interest rate as well as capital flows in the region. For future topics, well, there's a lot of things: external adjustment, current account, exchange rate. No one's writing on that anymore. Financial stability implication of capital flows. That would be a good topic as well. We've talked a lot about the drivers of capital flows, but not much on the impact. You know, I mean, look at it the other way around. Why are we so concerned with capital flows? What is its impact on growth? What's impact on exchange rate, on other key variables or parameters that policymakers may be more concerned about? And of course, capital flows data itself. You know, I did I'm very I'm a capital flows data enthusiast. I mean, I've written a paper on papers on bilateral flows, sectoral flows. I've always wanted to do something capital flows based on different currencies. But in terms of the data, you know, how do we can cross-border invest? How can we capture, you know, green cross-border investment, as well as how can we capture, let's say, investment in the future that could be done by CBDCs or digital currencies? Should they take off? You know, since should they be a key? Should the volume of transactions, cross-border transactions in these currencies increase? How do we act? How can that be captured on this, on the balance of payment statistics? So that is actually a very interesting topics that we can certainly think about for future issues of the monitor.
Wonderful. This has been a very interesting conversation. So thank you for that. Sort of coming to the close, in your view, what are some innovations or refinements that you would like to see in future editions of the Capital Flows Monitor, and why?
Okay, for this issue, if you read the first section, I think the first three paragraphs were talking about forecast of output, forecast of inflation, and because we were sort of setting the tone for the relevance of interest rate, particularly say the U.S. interest rate, as well as domestic interest rate. So it would be nice. I mean, when I was writing it, I was like, it would be nice if our can CSET have our own sort of forecast, you know, for our region. Do we need to have one? You know, that sort of raises that question. I mean, what other, you know, data or information we can generate prior to writing the report. So I think that's something. I mean, we may not necessarily need to do individual country forecasts, but we may need to combine them, you know, aggregate them. Those forecasts can be coming from our member central banks, but then we just need to aggregate and, you know, at least have a consistent value or a value of our own, a forecast value of our own. And then, that's one thing that would be a very nice sort of additional output for the capital flows monitor. And I don't know how this will evolve in the future. I mean, should we talk about only capital flows or are there other important policy topics that we can discuss in which is in line with our, you know, work from our stakeholders? So yeah, I would that's an innovation, whether having that sort of forecast, whatever form that would take, which we can use in the report. That's something that would be a very nice innovation. I know you're an expert in forecasting, so I'm sort of saying, if you have time, you know, you can sort of can we have like a common forecast for this? So yeah, that's it. That's what, you know, that's one innovation that would be nice. A wish list.
Good. We shall keep it in mind. Yes. Thank you. for the very interesting, very thought-provoking discussion of the December 2023 Capital Flows Monitor. We're both in KL, so the location is not quite as exotic as Siem Reap.
Yes.
But I again very much enjoyed talking to you about the
same
Capital
year,
Flows Monitor. And I'm not going to wish our listeners a happy new year. It's a bit late for that, but I'd still like to wish them a successful, enjoyable, healthy, and prosperous 2024. And Rogelio and I will be back at some point
Thank you so much, Ole, for giving time, taking time, and putting this in as your first podcast for the year. And this nicely ties up with our institution's release of the reissue of the Capital Flows Monitor. So thank you so much for your support on this whole publication. I mean, thank you as well for your review, for your comments, feedback on the report. And I hope to be back in the future.
No, I mean, it's obviously something that goes straight to the heart of what we do at the CSEN Center in terms of keeping an eye on capital flows. And Roger did a great job in explaining some very complex topics and issues. But we've only scratched the surface today in terms of the overall importance and influence of capital flows on a whole range of economic aspects. Keep your eye out on either future podcasts or on future analytical sections that delve deeper into the pervasive influence of capital flows on all sectors of the macro financial world. Roger mentioned, financial stability, which we haven't touched upon at all in this. So capital flows really is a very important topic for the region, and we will try to stay ahead of the curve in the research and the analysis that we do. So thank you very much for joining us today for listening to our podcast.
Thank you.
Roger, and hopefully we'll be back soon with another podcast. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to today's podcast. Subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and other major podcast platforms so you won't miss any upcoming episodes. If you have a comment or question for our hosts and speakers, email us at podcast@csen.org and follow us on our LinkedIn page at CSEN Center.